Welcome to The Fight with Teddy Atlas, presented by Dynamic Striking. I'm Ken Rideau, joined as always by Boxing Hall of Famer, the great Teddy Atlas. Teddy, how you feeling?
Yeah, good. I went to the surgeon today, and all my rehab people up in the city at HSS, and they gave me the okay to, in 2 days, not to have to wear the brace anymore. I already chucked away the crutches about 4 days ago. Couple days before they gave me the official okay, but I knew it would be okay because I made up my mind it would be okay. No more crutches, just, you know, got to take it a little bit easy. The rehab's going, I'm ahead of schedule, which I want to get further ahead in schedule, of schedule, because they said it's a 9 to 12 month rehab, and I have an agreement with my physical therapist would do it in 5 months. So I want to try to make that happen and see if we could get at least 5.5 months, but whatever. But everything's coming good. And then I'll be going and seeing my buddy Charlie Monahan soon. And my son went back after babysitting me and nursemaiding me for the last 3 weeks from Saudi Arabia to Staten Island, New York. He finally got back to his beautiful family and his son and his wife. They were missing him terribly. He went back Friday. My daughter's been, you know, incredible. My wife, everybody. So I'll be glad not to be a pain in their freaking, more of a pain in their neck than usual with having to worry about me as much as they had been. But it'll be nice to get out to Vegas, see Charlie Monahan, my friend, who directs all the UFC stuff, to get out there for the UFC 300 in about 10 days or whatever it is, or less than 2 weeks, be out there for that show and see my son again out there. And I hope everybody had a happy Easter, a great Easter. And I also hope that people are happy with not the boxes.
NCAA brackets?
Yeah, with the brackets.
The brackets.
Crazy, really. But what a story. I mean, what a tournament. So many upsets, so many great stories. Such a test of the old adage of will versus skill. Every week you're seeing a smaller team beat a bigger team because they outwill them. They outsmart them for that particular day. Whatever. The stars line up and make just great, great drama. And the North Carolina State, you know, it's been since 1983, the great late Jimmy Valvano, who won the national title, they were a huge underdog. They only got into the tournament because they would not have been eligible except they won their, I guess it was the ACC even back then, but they won their tournament to get an automatic bid. Otherwise, they wouldn't even got in. And Jimmy Valvano pulls off the huge upset, him and his team. And then now, he passed away with cancer. And then ESPN started the Jimmy V Foundation in his name to try to come up with a cure for cancer, and it's raised hundreds of millions of dollars with Dick Vitale, with all the people at ESPN pushing it, with Jimmy Valvano and his family pushing it. Incredible. And one of the greatest speeches of all time, when Jimmy Valvano got the Arthur Ashe Award, and he went up on a stage, you know, dying of cancer, and he goes up there and he gives the speech, basically, you know, don't give up, don't ever give up. And then, of course, as I already said, the Jimmy V Foundation was born after his passing, and they raised all this money for cancer. It's reminiscent. It's almost like you feel like Jimmy Vano has got a courtside seat up in the clouds, and he's, you know, it's like he's rooting on or even, you know, pushing on this North Carolina State team, whose coach is doing a phenomenal job, whose whole team, I mean, a very similar to the 1983 miraculous run that they made to win a national title, North Carolina State Wolfpack. Because this year, They weren't going to make the NCAA tournament. They had lost four straight games at the end of the season, and then they get into the ACC tournament, and they win five straight games in 5 days and knock off the number one seed, North Carolina, in the finals. And then they get to the, you know, automatic bid. Otherwise, they wouldn't have got in. They get an automatic bid to this incredible tournament, the NCAA tournament, and everyone said, okay, they can't keep up that emotional ride. The magic's going to end. And then they win another game. Okay, the magic end now. They win another game. The magic end, they win another. And now they've won nine straight games since the ACC tournament, and then four in the NCAA tournament, and they're in the Final Four. I mean, I don't know if anything is beyond them now. I mean, UConn is a monster. They're a monster. I mean, they're Mike Tyson when Mike Tyson looked like he was unbeatable, you know, or when Muhammad Ali was Muhammad Ali. That's them. They look like they're just on another level. And then Purdue is looking incredible. But how can you discount, how can you count out a team like North Carolina State that is, forget about them playing with house money now, but they're just on some kind of magical roll. I mean, it's incredible. And of course, that'll be coming up next week. And did you see the tournament, Ken? I mean, it was
it's been fantastic.
I mean, really.
I like this kid from NC State, the big kid, DJ Burns.
Yeah, he is so big, yet he's got huge. But yet he's got a gentle touch on the shot. You know what I mean?
He's so athletic. It seems to like defy logic. He's just like banging underneath, and then he's hitting like finesse shots. So smooth, so strong.
It's a great story. It really is. It's a great story.
Yeah, it is.
And the whole thing is just tremendous. But I know you had your race. How did you do? I'm going to give you that plug there. My son said, Dad, this Ken is becoming big. I looked at his social media. He's getting big. You created another monster, Dad. You create monsters. He said, and then, of course, it's my son, so he gives me credit, for the sun coming up in the morning. He goes, UConn, Dad, you created another monster with UConn. He goes, last year you talked to them, they win the whole thing out of nowhere. This year, of course, they're the favorite. And he goes, they're monsters. So if my son was my PR guy, I'd be on the cover of Time magazine. I don't even know if there's a Time magazine anymore. But anyway, yeah. How did you – you had that race from California to Vegas. It was a 300-mile race. I'm just going to tell you the little bit I know, and then you fill it in. But it was a 300-mile race. There was about 400 runners, and it was unregistered, whatever the word is, unregulated,
unsanctioned.
Yeah, unsanctioned race. Where you had the 400 runners that do Ironman stuff for a collection of different stuff, marathons, of course, everything else. And you had different teams that ran from there to Vegas. I think you got there on Saturday. So go ahead. Tell me how it went.
Yeah. There were 77 teams of six people, four guys, two girls, and a friend of mine had invited me to participate with his team, and I agreed to do it. And the guy who asked me, a guy named Nick Bear, really nice guy, very hard worker, wanted to win. But I can tell you that, I don't know, I feel like people like me, you, and other people like to have a slightly different mindset. So when you ask us to participate in a team event and everyone doesn't have the mindset of I'm going to kill somebody or myself to win this race, it can be incredibly frustrating when you're turning yourself inside out for, you know, over the course of 36 hours, we're running 3 mile increments. So I run 3 miles, then everyone else on the team does their 3 miles, and we're sitting in Jeeps and RVs because we had to go through the about 100 miles of off-roading in the desert to get there. So we're all crammed into a Jeep through the night, no sleep. So when I'm killing myself and then I look out and someone else is out there jogging around like they're on an effing fun run, needless to say, I was pissed at some of the people, and they probably were pissed at me for wanting to win so bad. We end up coming in fourth place, but it's a race that I don't know if we could have won, but we absolutely could have been in the top three had we all adopted that mindset of, like, let's do everything we can to win. And, you know, it taught me a valuable lesson. I blame myself as much as anyone else because I should have asked the question. Is like, is everyone here committed to winning? I don't want to do... These races to me aren't fun to participate. And I know some people like to do races to participate, and that's great. That's excellent. But I don't, and I don't want to be party to that. And I did agree to this without doing my research. So I bear all the responsibility for getting into this. But that being said, I did the best that I could. I was running maybe like an average of just under 5 minute miles for over the course of whatever I did, like 35 miles or something. It was 300 miles total. Like I said, 100 miles was completely off-road. And when I say off-road, it was like through the desert in the dark of the night, like pitch black. It was hard. But of all the difficulties, not sleeping through the night, through Saturday.
How do you avoid, and I'm not being a wise guy. How do you avoid like rattlesnakes or whatever, the scorpions or whatever they get? How do you avoid walking on one of those or the running snakes on one of them in the desert with no light?
Typically, snakes and scorpions are stretched out on the trail during the sunlight, and at night they're like hiding out of the sun. I had a little headlamp, like a band around your head that has a little light on it. That's actually very, very effective.
Oh, sure.
And the Jeeps are driving behind us with the high beams on, so you can kind of see, but it was, it definitely wasn't easy. And like I said, not sleeping through the night and exercising for 36 straight hours was definitely the hardest thing I've ever done, like physically. It was like my brain and body at early in the morning on the second day were kind of not connected. It was like my motor skills were off. I was just like, you know, when they talk about Hell Week at for the Navy SEALs, like, I don't know how those guys stay awake for a week. I still don't feel right. And it's like 2 days later. The no sleeping was hard, but it was at the end of the day, we did it in just under 36 hours. I got to Vegas, and within, I don't know, 3 hours, I was on a plane heading home to make it home in time for Easter. So,
oh, beautiful. Well, listen, congratulations. Great effort. Great work. Fourth, let me tell you, I get it. But fourth is pretty damn good with those numbers, with those kind of with those kind of runners, those kind of athletes, and those kind of that kind of terrain, those kind of circumstances. You know what? Fourth is pretty damn good, considering all the circumstances you just laid out.
Yeah.
So, congratulations. On that.
Thank you.
And congratulations on just making yourself better, because forget about the, you know, placement. You just did something that takes extreme, you know, discipline, extreme effort, extreme commitment, extreme preparation, and you're better for it. I mean, you are better today than you were last week. So it makes you a better person, makes you a stronger person. It makes you a more able person. It makes you a person that realizes that really you just showed yourself again that there are no limitations to what we can do if we're prepared to do it, if we're motivated enough, and if we prepare properly. And again, if we're driven enough, we're almost unlimited to what we can accomplish, you know, within the reign of, you know, we're not talking about stuff that only machines can do, but the human being can do so many things that a lot of people just eliminate from the possibility by not trying it.
Yeah.
You know, by not giving themselves an opportunity to find out, you know, how far can they go? You know, how much can I endure?
Right.
How good can I be? How special can I, you know, perform? And It's tantamount to what I always say when I talk about fighters that go to that special place and you watch the fight. You can't believe you're watching a real life fight. You think you're watching some kind of superhuman movie or something where it's fictional because of the where they take their body, where they take their minds, you know, and you're saying, oh my God, you know, how are they doing that? You know, and it's very similar to the what I always say as the easiest way to get a sort of a picture of it, what it would be, is it's like you have a house. Your house is your body, your mind, your being, and your house has so many rooms. And there are a lot of rooms in everyone's house that are never visited, that are never opened, that are just left dusty, if you will. And each time you come to one of these, you know, places where you're demanded to do something that you never did before, you're challenged with the proposition of opening another room in your house, and a room that's never been opened before, and you don't know what to fix in it, but you know that it's another room in the house. And you open up that room and you find out that there's somewhere else you can go in the house. And then you get to the next room. You open that door. There's somewhere else you can go. How many rooms are you willing to open up in your house during the course of your life when you go and get demanded you demand of yourself some extraordinary efforts that had never been demanded before? So you open some more doors in your house, put it that way, that were never opened before. And that makes you better. You know, that makes you better. So anyway, let's get to the fights that were not in the desert. Or they might have been. Some of them might have been, but not actually in the sand dunes.
Let's start with a real turkey of a fight, and that's Rolly Romero. If you're going to talk the way he talks, you best not be getting battered around the ring and start moonwalking across on dead legs after you talk the kind of crap he talks. And you know, if you're going to talk like Floyd Mayweather, you should probably fight like him too. And Rolly Romero did not do that as he got humiliated against Isaac Cruz. 8th round stoppage, referee jumps in and shows mercy on Romero and calls off the dogs. Isaac Cruz looked like a pit bull in there. He looked like you could have hit him in the head with a hammer. Rolly hit him with some good shots, but Isaac Cruz was like walking right through them, returning the favor. And like I said, he put him on roller skates multiple times. Just an awesome performance for Cruz and quite humiliating for Romero, although I don't know if he's even, he might be immune to that kind of humiliation, the way he talks, but how'd you like that one?
Well, talking about the way he talks, I'll start there. After the fight and the post-fight press conference, there was a lot of strange stuff about the whole broadcast, but I don't know. Some of the interviews, it was just, I don't know, it just seemed a little strange, some of stuff. Maybe
they shouldn't even interview him after he's been knocked out senseless. He sounded crazy.
I mean, just seeing him being interviewed afterwards, it wasn't fair to put him in that position, I don't think, because
that's very, very true.
Yeah, because he was concussed still. You could see it. I mean, you know, I know a lot of people don't like him, and what you said is fair, and the way he talks, and he doesn't back it up, and the way he's been babied, or the way he's been, seems to have been protected, to always get the benefit of the doubt, and always get taken care of in a way that some fighters never get taken care of, and back in that position again to make money, to have a title, whatever kind of title, I don't know what kind of title it was, and then to, you know, be able to defend it in a big spot again. I know a lot of people don't like him, but to hear him talk, it was just absurd. It was ridiculous, and like I said, strange, you know. Just to,
and by the way, the fight was for a WBA super lightweight 140 title.
I mean, just to see the way he was talking, and then he had just taken a beating, he had just been stopped. It sounded like he wanted at first it was like he was just poo-pooing the whole thing, like Cruz is not. Then he skipped over that. He didn't finish with that. And it's like he tried to make up for what he said, like to make amends or to make the crowd, you know, not hate him by just saying happy Easter to everybody. I hope everyone has a happy Easter.
Too late.
Yeah, it was just...
You ain't winning the crowd back with a few, like, consolation comments after you've been battered. You win them back by fighting and backing up your words and not talking reckless about people all the time.
Yeah, he's a strange guy, and him and his father just... It's almost like he's had a trumped life where he's been the anointed one without having to earn it. It's like he's been given so many opportunities. I think to call him a champion, I think it would probably be fair without trying to ridicule him, but just to give him the same treatment that we would give any fighter in similar circumstances, to hold them accountable, to put them under the microscope, in a way that is just responsible. If you're going to be out there saying things and, you know, putting yourself in a light that he does, then of course there's a need to be accountable when you don't live up to those things. And not everyone lives up to them, but not everyone gets that many opportunities as he did, and not everybody talks as brash as he has. Some do, but I think it's almost fair to call him a paper champion, really, because, you know, once he got a chance to really prove it, he came up way short. And what do I base that on? Well, he'd been knocked out. Obviously, he'd been knocked out by Tank, right, when he got that chance. And then he was losing to Barossa before Tony Weeks controversially stopped it, right? And he had lost, as I said before this fight, a fight 4 years ago, you know, to Jackson, I want to make sure I have his name right, Jackson Marinez. I saw that fight. I mean, he lost that fight every way to Sunday. He lost that fight. He gets that gift, and then he gets taken care of by Heyman and PBC. He gets put back into, you know, gets a title. Never, like I said, this was an opportunity to shut up the naysayers, to prove that there was a worth to him. And, it was a fight that, in this way, nobody could really help him. Like nobody helped him in the Tank fight, but he got helped in the Barossa fight. And in this time, there was nobody to help him. You know, he was in there with a solid, solid fighter who goes by the name of Pitbull, rightfully so. He lives up to that fighting name. He looked like a mini version of Joe Frazier.
He really did. He looked indestructible. He looked so thick.
Yeah, he's strong. He's physically strong. He's relentless with his attitude, with his pressure, with his aggression. And you know what? He gives the misperception that he's recklessly aggressive, but he's moving his head, he's slipping. He gets hit, but he's slipping, he's making you miss some punches. And then his offense serves as part of his defense because he keeps you so defensive that sometimes it's hard to get the shot off the right way, or it's hard to continue the flow of shots because you got to worry about what's coming back. So his offense becomes part of his defense. His movement, like I said, a mini young Joe Frazier, moving his head, that helps defensively. He gets in close. He knows what to do. He goes to the body. He switches up to the head. And you know what else makes it hard? Like you mentioned in a right way that he got caught some shot. That was Romero's only chance, to catch him a right hand coming in and to knock him out. And Romero was trying to do that. To his credit, he had the right approach, understanding he can't stand with the guy. He was trying to stay on the outside and trying to nail him counter right hands coming in. And he couldn't quite catch him. When he did catch him, one of the things that Cruz does so well, and I was shocked that the commentators didn't mention this, he keeps his chin tucked in as good as you can. That's about as good as I've ever seen a fighter. I always want fighters to keep their chin low. I do drills in the gym where I make them keep a pad under, a little pad underneath their chin while they hit the heavy bag or when they shadow box. So if they pick their head up and falls, they got to start over. Keep your chin down. Roll your eyes up. Protect your chin. Don't have it up in the air like some fighters, like a lantern in the storm. If Paddy the Batty, you know, the budding star in the UFC, could keep his chin down like Cruz, he'd have that much more of a chance to make it through the difficult fights that still lay in front of him in his career in the UFC when it comes to striking. But again, he kept his chin down. So even when he got caught, you couldn't catch him really clean on the chin. He did a marvelous job, Cruz. He had a real good fight plan and understanding of exactly what he had to do with Romero. He knew that he had to work his way in, that Romero would try to nail him a right hand coming in and hurt him. He understood that he had to get in the right way, moving his legs, taking steps, moving his head. And then he understood two other things. When he got inside, he had to do damage. He had to go to the body, and he had to break the will of a guy who, up to now, hadn't shown us if he had a will. Because he got knocked out by Tank. He was struggling against Barossa. You know, he got a help from the referee Weeks in a Barossa fight. He got a gift against Jackson Marinez a few years ago. So we didn't really know what constituted this guy. We really didn't know fully. We knew he could punch. But other than that, we didn't know really what he could do. We didn't know what he could overcome. We didn't know what he could withstand. We didn't know what he really was as a fighter. And then we got a peek at it here against Cruz. And Cruz understood that. He said, I want to find out too. You know, I want to kick the tires in this nice looking car, whatever. I want to open up the hood and see what's under the hood. And he understood, Cruz understood with his fight plan, that means put pressure on, you know, pressure breaks pipes, pressure breaks men, put pressure, relentless pressure, see if he can stand up to it. And when you get inside, when you get close, go to the body, take his legs away, keep going to the body. And one other part that they were very prepared, him and his trainers. They understood when he did get close, he was going to force him out of the pocket. And when Romero goes out of the pocket, which a lot of fighters do, but when Romero goes out of the pocket, he'll go straight out and he'll go out tall. In other words, he'll go out in a vulnerable fashion where if you follow him the way Joe Frazier followed Muhammad Ali in their fight of the century, in their first fight at the Garden, you're going to catch him a left hook if that's the punch you're throwing. And that's what he throws, left hooks. And left hooks can catch you when you go back because you can throw them wide. You can throw them long. You can throw them as you're stepping. And that's exactly, and he planned that. Cruz, to his credit, He gets credit from me for the cerebral approach. Not just he's tough, not just that he's physical, but because of all the things I'm pointing out. He knew that when I get in close, I'm going to work the body and I'm going to force this guy out of the pocket. And when he retreats out of the pocket, he's going to be vulnerable. I'm going to go with him. I'm going to catch him going out of the pocket. And he did. He caught him with right hands and left hooks going out of the pocket. So completely prepared, Cruz, give him all the credit in the world. He definitely exposed Romero. You when you see a guy like Romero get this many opportunities, Ken, it's kind of like that old joke. You start to think, you know what? This promoter's going so far out of his way for this guy. What has he got on this guy? Does he have pictures on him? You know, I mean, you I know nobody else is going to say that, but anyway, the truth is the truth. At the end of the day, he truly was on his own. You had a chance to see what Romero really was, and he was up against really a guy that you find out the truth about, you know, a real truth, a truth machine, a real truth. And Joe Frazier, I think it was the great Larry Merchant who used to call the fights on HBO. I think he called Joe Frazier. He labeled him. He gave him the moniker, a truth machine. And that's what this Cruz is. He's a truth machine. And, you know, he reminds me of a fighter.
Or a lie detector.
Yeah, he reminds me, yes. He reminds me of a fighter that just fought from London, from England, that fought in Saudi Arabia when I was just out there with my son. And he fought a draw for the title. I forget what title, if it was the featherweight, junior lightweight. His name was Ball, B-A-L-L. I think that's what his name was. And he's very, look him up, and he's very similar to this kid Ball, who just fought a 12-round draw. A lot of people thought he won the fight in Saudi Arabia, but he fought a draw against the champion, so he didn't
Nick Ball drops Ray Vargas twice in that fight.
You know what? This kid Ball, Cruz is very similar. The two of them fight in a very similar way, very aggressive, very tough kids. You know, relentless pressure. The only difference is that Cruz is physically stronger and better. He's more experienced. He's been in there with better fighters so far, and he's a little bit better, but very similar to that kid, Ball.
Nick Ball.
Yeah. Very, thank you for looking that up. Very similar to him.
By the way, that was Rolly's third loss in a row, if you count the Barboza loss. He's been stopped twice, and he clearly lost a decision to Barboza that they gifted him. Not looking good for Rolly at stepping up to the next level here.
No, I mean, again, you're getting a chance to really see what he is. You know, not what he talks and not all that stuff and that, you know, he's what potential because he could punch a bit. Not all that. You see what, you know, what is really there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like getting in the CAT scan, getting in the X-ray machine.
There's a big difference between speaking with confidence and carrying yourself with conviction and just being a jerk all the time and talking reckless. And I think of a guy like Terrence Crawford. Like Terrence Crawford just keeps it. He's just confident. I never see him disrespecting people. I mean, he gets into it with everyone, but he's a perfect example of the guy's just all business. Then he gets in the ring, and he's mean as a son of a bee. And then you get Rolly talking disrespectful and reckless, and he gets in there and gets battered three fights in a row. I just don't I just don't understand the rationale there. Nevertheless, third loss in a row for Rolly.
One other thing I got to say before we move on to this. As far as what you just said, I think sometimes guys talk a little reckless and a little over the top because they're trying to build themselves up for what they don't truly feel themselves, that they're a little insecure in those areas. But aside from that, again, I wish I wasn't saying this, but again, proof that we really do need a national commission. I mean, nobody's, you fans out there, come on. I mean, you're not, I mean, I know you must have ate a lot of Easter eggs and maybe you're a little bit, you know what I mean? You're in a Easter egg coma, right? But are you not upset about the one judge that really, that had Cruz losing, had Romero winning the fight? At the end of the fight?
At this point, Teddy, I think it's expected. Honestly, I think fight fans expect this BS.
But that's a problem.
Who had that guy winning? He was getting smashed.
But one judge, one professional judge.
I know.
That has the responsibility and the ability to change a man's life and his family's life by giving a corrupt, you know, score. Or either corrupt or incompetent.
I wouldn't say he has the ability. He has the responsibility to tell the damn truth. And we don't even expect it. That should have been what we led with, talking like, can you believe someone scored this for Romero? And instead, we just kind of mentioned it in passing.
This judge and all the professional judges out there with that responsibility, they have the ability to change the course of a man's life. And in a bad way. Good way, bad way.
That's right.
And this, I don't know if he's incompetent or corrupt, But either one's unacceptable. No, it's unacceptable. Yep. He had Romero winning that fight, a beatdown of a fight. And he had him ahead. I mean, and nobody's going crazy over that. Nobody's making sure that this judge never judges again.
Even the other judges, Teddy, should be like, this guy can't be in our crew.
I want to do our part. I want to put a wanted poster up with his picture. Can Rob do that? With his picture and his name. At least his name. Let's put it up. A wanted poster that, you know, he's wanted for dangerous scoring, perilous to fight his health and careers, and the legitimacy of the sport. All right? He's wanted for that. He's wanted for destroying the legitimacy of a great sport and potentially the careers of a fighter. What is this? You got to put him up. He's got to be on the most wanted poster. We got to start the most wanted posters where these judges, really, until we get that national commission, we're just going to have to, you know, put up these posters and say, hey, don't let this guy anywhere near a ring. Or definitely don't let him anywhere near your fighter. Do not allow him near, you know, like those fire trucks on the back, stay 500 feet away, 500 yards away from the truck. Well, keep this guy 500 yards away from any boxing arena, from any ring, from any fighter, because he's dangerous. He's dangerous.
It was Chris Flores is the judge's name. Chris Flores had Rolly up 66-65. The other two judges had it. Max DeLuca had it 69-63. And Patricia Morse-Jarman had it 68-64. And Chris Flores saw the fight as 66-65 in favor of Romero. When I look at a fight, I always think, which guy would you rather be at the end of each round? I guess Chris Flores would rather have been Romero through that fight, if that's what he's saying. He needs his head examined.
No.
There's no other way to look at it.
Oh, he needs his bank account examined. Maybe if some extra money came in. I don't know this. I'm just talking. I don't know. I have no proof of such things.
I wonder, in all seriousness, I wonder how much it would take to compromise the man's integrity to say, yep, I saw that this way, when everyone in the world knows you're lying. What would that cost? $100,000? $100 million? There has to be a price. Hey, will you score it for $20?
Yeah, and look, and let me be clear, we're not saying that he got paid. We're not saying we know anything close to that. We're not saying that. We're frustrated. We're just saying that it's wrong. We're just saying that it goes on too much, too often, that you see these decisions where one judge will have it, you know, eight rounds the other way, and then two judges might have it that way. And then one judge will have it a point or two for the other guy. And you're like, how's that possible? How is that, you know? And it's either, it's not that difficult. It's, you know, it's not a real large multiple choice question where you have to go through a lot of, you know, a lot of options of what it could be. It could only be two things. Terrible incompetence or corruption. I mean, what else could it be? I mean, the guy got punched from pillar to post. I mean, really, how the freak?
It was so bad, the referee had to show mercy on him and say, like, no, I can't let you keep going. You're going to get hurt. You're in too deep, son. And the other judge is looking at it going, no, ref, what are you doing? He's winning. Don't stop the fight.
And the round that he got, you know, stopped. I mean, really, where the referee, he was hurt and the referee stopped it. He took a horrible beating around before that.
He should have been stopped there. His corner should have stopped it too.
It's possible, but man, I mean, if he survived, what was the judge going to have him winning? I guess that was, that's what he was headed towards. I mean,
yeah,
let's move on, but wow, that's terrible.
All right, let's get to some more questionable judging. Tim Zhu suffers as bad a cut as you've ever seen. I saw Stitch Duran said maybe that vein that runs down the middle of your forehead, maybe that vein got popped because that's the way it was bleeding. He said there's not a lot you can do to stop it, but the cut man didn't do anything right, apparently. I'm not a cut man, but that's what Stitch Duran said in a Twitter post. But the cut was terrible. But Fandora also looked like he had a broken nose, was bleeding profusely from the mouth and nose. Just an absolute bloodbath of a fight. It was an incredible fight. I couldn't believe Fandora did as well as he did. I thought for sure Tim Zhu was going to knock him out 100%. So congratulations to Fandora. I thought Tim Zhu won the fight, but I thought it also should have been stopped when given that the accidental foul so early in the fight after the second, at the end of the second round, should have just been a do-over. It wasn't. They let it continue, and Tim Zhu was clearly blinded throughout the whole fight with blood in his eyes. And again, it's no favoritism. I've said from the beginning, I really like Fandora. I'm happy to see him get a world title. I don't think that he won the fight, but nevertheless, no one cares about my opinion. What did you think, Teddy?
No, I thought he won a fight. I thought he won a fight on the scorecards, the way the fight played out. You almost want to put an asterisk next to the fight, and I'm not. But you almost want to, because there's no doubt on this planet that cut in the second round on the top of the head of Zhu changed the course of this fight. No doubt. I thought he was possibly on his way to stopping. I know it was only two rounds. But I like the way Zhu was stepping in. He was closing the gaps, not recklessly, very patiently, closing the gaps, landing to the body, landing right hands to the head, and with power shots. He was getting in position to catch the tall, long, very tall Fandora, who was coming off a devastating knockout loss in his last fight. He was getting inch by inch, getting closer and closer to where I think he was going to do some damage. And then all of a sudden, bang, the floodgates open. Literally open with the blood. And it changed the course. I used the same words because they're the only words you can use. It changed the course of the fight. Now, I take nothing away from Fandora, what he did the rest of the way, you know, dealing with, you know, with the opportunity in front of him, blood everywhere. He, first of all, I want to congratulate Amazon and the people that moved over from, you know, I was very hard on them. I'd still be hard on them when I need to. But I will give them credit that the show was better. I didn't know if it was the best debuting show to, you know, to kind of hit Broadway with after you get closed down at Showtime and then Amazon gives you a chance and you come up with this show where originally you got Zhu fighting Keith Thurman, who'd been injured so many times, inactive so many times, and then he does get injured a couple weeks before the fight. They got to replace Fandora, who'd been knocked out cold in his last fight, and they got to replace him on 2 weeks' notice. And so I didn't know that it was really the... And then, of course, Cruz Romero is the co-feature. Turned out to be a one-sided fight. But all in all, the show was better than it could have been. It could have been a lot worse. So I think they kind of pulled it off. That for their debut show on Amazon, PBC, maybe they got away with one, whatever you want to call it. But they at the end of the day, they put on a pretty good show, pretty good fight. And I think the fans were satisfied. And I think that the people at Amazon were probably satisfied. So it turned out good for them, where it could have went the other way. It looked like what they were doing really, rightfully so, could have been a lot of criticism could have been thrown at it and would have been thrown at it had the fight been just a blowout. As it turned out, as fate will have it, the floodgates open up with blood and then you get an upset. You get a big upset. And credit to also the people over there at Amazon and the people now doing the show that came from PBC, went over to Amazon, came from Showtime, I should say. I don't know if it was an accident or what, but they put this show on early. And it ended by about 10:30, somewhere in that neighborhood. You know what? What a difference from the DAZN. We'll talk about it later. Ramirez in the cruiserweight title fight. That main event went on at 1 in the morning. And I was falling asleep trying to cover it for you guys, for the fans, for what we do. I was falling asleep. I had to keep waking up and rewind it, watch it again. It was ridiculous. It was all over by 10:30, and it was much more enjoyable. You weren't falling asleep, you know, as you're trying to watch it. I also want to say that my friend, the greatest PR man in boxing, and in any sport, really, to be honest, Fred Sternberg, he set me up where I could watch the live stream of the fight on pay-per-view.com. The picture was perfect. He set me up on that. I appreciate it, Fred. They did a great job with that. Getting back to the fight, Fandora, yeah, maybe it was his destiny to win a title. Him and his sister are now champions at the same time.
Yep.
She has a world title. First time a sister, brother had the titles at the same time. Tremendous. They have a nice family. They're all part of it. They all work, you know, in a corner. They work. The father trains them. It's a family affair. It's a great story to come back from that devastating knockout that sometimes destroys a fighter's career. Sometimes they never recover from that kind of knockout. Give credit that Fandora, again, he deserves it. But again, just the clouds of fate, whatever you want to call it, lined up, the stars lined up. With that cut, it gave Fandora an opportunity that I don't know if he could have pulled it out of under circumstances without that cut. I don't know. We'll never know. But he did pull it off. And I saw an improvement in him where he was learning to fight taller now, which was his undoing before. He's 6'7", he's 154 pounds, 160 pounds. He never fought tall. He never knew how to fight tall. He would fight inside and give you a great target to catch him, stand up in front of you, which is how he got knocked out in the fight before this. They showed that they understood that they needed to try to get better in that area. And he did. He did. He fought at a range that made sense with his long arms. He used his jab much more. He turned southpaw. He switched it up. He did it very simple, the way you should do it. He stood on the outside with his jab in the face of Zhu, trying to frustrate Zhu. And when Zhu would come in 6 inches, Fandora would go back 12 inches. That's what he did. That's what he did. And that's how you fight tall. That is one of the really main parts of knowing how to fight tall when you got those physical assets of height and length, which he does. He kept him on the outside. He kept Zhu a step behind him as much as he could. And he did it pretty consistently. When the blood started, he got a little more aggressive where he gave Zhu some more opportunities, really, again, to catch him giving up his height. But it didn't matter because with the blood obscuring the vision of Zhu and bothering Zhu the way that it did, Zhu was never really able to maintain that offense the way he needed to. He fought a game fight. I mean, there were rounds. The rounds were simple. Every round, Fandora outworked Zhu with that jab. I mean, that jab was like I talk about where it's like a nest of gnats at a picnic, you know, a swarm of gnats, and it just won't leave you alone, and it'll destroy your picnic. If Zhu went in there thinking he was going to have a picnic with a guy who had been knocked out his last fight, well, it destroyed his picnic immediately. Again, Fandora, to me, the scoring was pretty obvious every round. Vador was outworking him every round. It was just a matter of the rounds that Zhu got in position to land power shots. Not more shots, but more decisive shots, more damaging shots, more telling shots, cleaner shots. And when he did, he won the round. But Vador outworked him every round. But when Zhu got in there to land a two or three or four clean right hands, or a clean right hand to the body, or a clean left hook to the head, even if he was outworked 50 to 10, those rounds, Zhu won when he landed those clean shots. But when he wasn't able to land beyond two or three of those clean shots, Fedor won a round with his jab. And he set the table for the power punch, whether it was the left hand behind the jab when he was southpaw or the right hand when he was orthodox. He set the table pretty well. And again, Fedora kept it simple. He controlled range. He used his... He took advantage of his physical assets where he kept Zhu one step behind him trying to get in and countering him when he tried to get in. Here's something I thought that the commentators might have missed. Not that they did anything wrong, but they talked about the bleeding. They didn't have to. Everybody, that was self-explanatory. We saw the blood. It was terrible. But they never mentioned, it was obvious that he was being bothered by it. He was rubbing his face, trying to get the blood out of his eyes. That was obvious. And it threw him off mentally, I think. Because when it happened initially, Zhu went from that patient guy that I thought was slowly but surely going to get to his man to all of a sudden he had to be more aggressive, a little more reckless, a little more impatient, and he wasn't the same guy. And it was hard to get that rhythm back. He lost it. But the thing that they never mentioned, aside from the obvious that the blood was obscuring the vision of Zhu, was the fact that he bled so long, so hard, that I wonder if it fatigued him. I wonder if it physically compromised Zhu by losing that much blood. That would have been my question if I was sitting there in one of those seats, you know, with a microphone in front of me. Okay, guys, we know he's compromised as far as his vision. Okay. Is he being compromised now and slowing down with his endurance on a physical level because of the loss of blood? That would have been my question. One of the other curious things that I thought was absurd was when they had, I think it was Khalid Plant's wife who was doing the sideline reporting, and she talked to the corner of Zhu. The right thing to do, to ask him about, you know, stopping the bleeding. And obviously he wasn't really having too much success stopping the bleeding. Now, before I go further, I know from 50 years in the business of working, I used to work all my cuts the early part of my career. I know, first of all, you got to have the right coagulants. You have to have the right medicines. You have to also be calm, get pressure on it, get the coagulants in there, keep pressure, and then, you know, put some cold Vaseline over it to try to hold it and get some help that it doesn't get hit again immediately. You need a little luck too. But the cuts to the head, they pump blood. They're blood pumpers. So it's very hard, very hard to stop. You saw it in the fight with Marcus Brown when he fought, who was the guy for the super middle or the light heavyweight?
Badu Jack.
Yeah, but that was a terrible cut. And that they couldn't get that.
That was as bad as I've seen.
Yeah, very in a similar area in the forehead. And they couldn't get Badu Jack's cut stopped. When it's the head, it pumps. Now, the difference from the head and the eyes, you have to worry about permanent structural damage around the eyes. But you can stop the bleeding easier. But you have to worry about the permanent damage structurally. You don't have to worry about that up in the head. But what you do have to worry about is the pumping of the blood. And so for any cut man, yeah, he didn't get it stopped. You don't need Teddy Atlas or you don't need Stitch, whatever his name is, to tell you that. That's clear. But it's much more difficult dealing with the head. Having said that, I did think it was a little bit ridiculous when the sideline reporter, Khalid Plant's wife, asked the corner man, the cut man of Zoo, what's going on with the cut? What do you think for the rest of the fight? Do you think you can, how's it look? And he says, it's a deep cut, which obviously it was, but I got the right medicines. Don't worry. I got it under control. We'll be fine. I got the right medicines. Well, it was pretty clear that you must not have had the right medicines. It was pretty clear that it wasn't going to be fine. And it was pretty clear that, it wasn't under control. Like, the evidence was pretty damning. It was pretty obvious. I mean, you're saying, don't worry, I got the right medicines. And meanwhile, the guy's bleeding like a stuck pig. You know what I mean? And exactly. And you're saying, well, I'd hate to see it if you had the wrong medicine. I mean, it might look like something from Reservoir Dog. That movie, yeah. that original movie of...
of course.
What's his name? The crazy...
Quentin Tarantino.
The great, brilliant director, Tarantino. I mean, it would look like something like that. If he didn't have the right medicines. At the end of the day, he might have been in the right place at the right time. That happens. It happens in life. The most important thing was he was ready to do his job when that time came. And Fundora did his job. And he did show improvement. He maintained distance better. He fought taller, better. And also... what he did was, when he used to get hit and he got away with it, and then he got knocked out in the fight before, obviously before this fight with Zoo, where when you got close to him, he would stand tall. And like I used to say on ESPN, it was like a skyscraper, a lot of windows to break. All you had to do was throw rocks and you're going to hit a window. All you had to do was throw a punch, you were going to hit a window. And this time, I saw a little improvement defensively where he moved his head or he dipped a little bit. He got small. When he was, instead of being tall, when Zoo got into range, he got small. And that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to get small. You're not supposed to stand tall. And I give him credit for that. I give his father credit for that, his sister credit for that, because it's a team effort with that family, all putting something into training him. And at the end of the day, congratulations. I feel bad for Zoo because of what happened, but I'll tell you one thing I don't feel bad about. I don't feel bad about getting to see the man that Zoo is. Not only that his fortitude, and the fortitude of Fundora too, but the fortitude of him to keep fighting, to just keep at his job, keep going, even with all that loss of blood and everything else. But after that fight, for him to talk the way he did, wow, what a man. What a champ. That's a champ. That's the epitome of a champion. That is the epitome of what you call class. That is a class act. That is sportsmanship at its best. That is a man behaving like a man when he had the stage where he could have easily said, hey, guys, what was I going to do? I mean, you saw I got hit with the elbow. I ran into the elbow. It's not like it was a purposeful elbow. He ran into the elbow. That's what initiated the cut. And he could have easily stood up there, Ken, and said, hey, the way he was bleeding, normally I would have beat him. Normally I would have done this. Normally I would have done... He didn't say any of that. He didn't use any excuses, legitimate excuses. But he didn't use any of that. That man really, it's so seldom you see it that it was refreshing. That it reminded me, that's what sportsmanship is. That's what class is. That's what a champion is. He gets up there and he says, Fandora was the better man. I take my hat off to him. I congratulate him. He did a great job. And I'll be back. I mean, you talk about the humility. You talk about the honesty. You just talk about the sheer class of a man. Wow. You know, you saw him when he's won. He's been a good winner, but now you saw him when he lost, and he was a magnificent. I won't even call him a loser. I won't even use that word. I won't. I'll say Fedora won, and he won, and he deserved to win. I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to stand here and say that Zou was a loser. He came out at the other end of the fight at the, you know, obviously the, not the end of the fight where you get your hand raised, you know, that went to Fandora, but the way he behaved at the end, the way he talked, that is not a loser. That is a gracious former champion that, you know, if it's meant to be, he'll be a champion again. I know right away you think about rematch, but I know the way it works. Right away you're going to see him and Spence. You don't need Teddy Atlas to tell you that because, you know, they're both with PBC, right? I'm correct about that, yep. Right? Yeah. They're both with PBC, yep, that's right. And that's it. You know, that's Heyman's M.O. That's PBC's M.O. And I'm not knocking him. Heyman has made more money for his fighters. Look, Eddie Hearn's made a lot of money for his fighters, too. De La Hoya has. They all have. But Al Heyman has made an enormous amount of money for all his fighters, even the ones that weren't, you know, as spectacular as some of the others. And he's done it with a simple formula. He controls the whole promotion for the most part, and he fights in-house. And he keeps everything in-house, like round robin. And that's not going to change. Fandora will stay in-house, and he'll fight Spence, I would guess. I would guess that Zou will see, you know, will heal up and see what makes sense. But hats off to both fighters.
Yeah, good one.
Hats off to both fighters. Congratulations to them. Congratulations to, you know, Amazon getting a much better than maybe could have been expected first show.
Yep, agreed. All right, let's get into, there was a ESPN show, Oscar Valdez, Lam Wilson. Valdez gets the 7th round TKO, bounce back after his loss to Emmanuel Navarrete. Referee stoppage in the 7th. How'd you like that one? I like Oscar Valdez.
Yeah, I mean, Valdez is a fighter. You know, it's in his blood.
Yep.
You know, it's in his blood. You got to feel, I don't know, you feel sorry for Wilson. You know, he had... both these fighters had been beaten by Navarrete, who I love. Navarrete's one of my favorite fighters. His guts, his style, you know, his approach. He makes exciting fights. He's a hurricane in that ring. He's a hurricane. And I love watching hurricanes. I do. I just don't want to be in the middle of one. But I love watching hurricanes. And that Navarrete is... Both these guys had lost to him. Wilson, you know, we just talked about the Fandora fight, where Fandora learned how to fight tall this time a little bit. Wilson, he's got to learn. He had to reach and height advantage, and he was using it to control the fight, control range early. First four rounds, somewhere around that, whatever it was, his left jab was keeping Valdez at a disadvantage, you know, where Wilson could hit him and Valdez couldn't reach him. And it was forcing Valdez to get reckless in spots, reach in spots, where then Wilson could counter. Wilson was doing really a superb job. And then he decides to turn southpaw, whatever. And then Wilson was hurting Valdez in spots. And I think that led to Wilson really being more aggressive and maybe to his demise, that it actually, that success actually worked against him. Because what it did was, it made him start getting more aggressive when he should have continued controlling it on the outside with his advantages of height and reach. And then he started giving up that advantage. And as I said, his success led to his downfall because he got closer than he should have. And I know the commentators said it was a lack of smarts. Yeah, I get it. I always say that. Everyone's saying it now. But I always say that, you know, you got two fighters, like Costamato would say, and they're both tough. But one is smarter. He becomes twice as tough. It is about being smart, not just tough. That's what differentiates fighters, what separates fighters. I've no doubt about it. And they said that. They pointed that out. But I thought it was something else. I thought it was also just simply a lack of discipline. I thought that when push came to shove, Wilson, because he had success, he lacked the discipline to stay where he should have stayed, on the outside. And that lack of discipline, not so much lack of smarts, for me at least, but the lack of control. Of emotional control over his emotions, of control over his emotions, where when he was having success, don't get giddy, don't get carried away, don't get drunk with it, stay outside, stay to the battle plan, stay disciplined, but he didn't. He got a little too close, and what happened? He got caught a beautiful counter left hook by Valdez. He got hurt. Valdez stayed on top of him, was relentless. He wasn't catching him everything clean. He was blocking some, but he was catching enough. But the main thing was Valdez was pouring punches on him, Ken, and he didn't give him a chance to respond. When he didn't respond, the referee was left with no choice but to stop it. But there was one other thing here. Like I said, yeah, you could say he wasn't smart. I'm going to say he lacked the discipline and the control over his emotions that led to his downfall. But there was one other thing that really led to his downfall. He stood too straight, and he was standing too straight from the beginning. From the beginning. It's just part of his technical approach or part of his technical flaws that don't get corrected by a trainer in the gym. You can't do it in the corner. You got to do it in the gym where it becomes a habit before the fight. And I thought that was his downfall. Yeah, you know, he lacked discipline. Yeah, he got too close and he got hit the left hook. But yeah, he was standing too straight. Even when he was having success in the early rounds by controlling range, he was still standing too tall. He never dipped a little bit. He never moved his head a little bit. He was just there too straight as a target. And he finally got caught with that left hook. Anyway, that was that one. What do you want to go on to next? Lawson and Rocha?
That's exactly right. Alexis Rocha defeated Frederick Lawson. That was on the co-main on the DAZN of Ramirez Gulamarian. Lawson's going to stop the fight after a one-sided seventh round. Lawson, you remember, was last in the ring with Virgil Ortiz. That's the fight where Tony Weeks, controversial, stopped it in the first round and allegedly said he saw a bad brain scan on Lawson before the fact, and then it was all deleted. So it's hard to say what the hell was the truth there, but Rocha beat him pretty handedly. Lawson looked pretty good considering how quickly he lost to Virgil Ortiz, although the ref was obviously stopped it way too soon, in my opinion. But what'd you think of that one? Did you think, how'd you like the performance from Rocha?
No, Rocha was workmanlike. He got hit some shots that he shouldn't have got hit with. They're going to have to correct his defense, where sometimes after he punches, he takes a picture, he admires his work, and when Lawson threw back, he got caught by surprise. You should never get caught by surprise. He got caught standing there looking at his work, and he's got to correct that. But other than that, the reason I put this on our schedule to cover, where we could have left this one off, could have left it off. I like to try to cover everything for the fans. But the reason I wanted to cover this real fast was because of what you just touched on, that Lawson, first of all, where I disagree with you is this. I agree and disagree, and that's very rare. But where I agree with you is Lawson looked good in a way. He was game. He was behaving like a fighter. He was coming back in at spots with counter punches and catching Rocha in spots. He was responding offensively after he got caught something. He would respond with offense. In that way, I give credit to Lawson. I agree with you. In a way that I disagree, where I just see something nobody else is looking at, I thought from the opening bell, Lawson had old legs. They had old legs, like your grandmother's spaghetti the day after. Sam's looking because Sam, you know, he understands that. You know, it's soggy. It's a little soggy. It's a little wet noodly. His legs were wet
noodly. The opposite of El Dante?
Yeah, instead of El Dante. You know, how do you like your grits? like in the movie My Cousin Vinny. I like mine El Dante. El Dante. Yeah. I don't know if anybody El Dante. I don't know if anyone has grits El Dante. But anyway, that's what Joe Pesci said in My Cousin Vinny. Lawson's legs were wet and noodly from the beginning, as they were in the Virgil Ortiz fight. That concerns me. Yeah, his upper body was okay with punches. I don't care about that. I look at the lower body. That tells the story. There's damage. There's neurological damage. There's sharp worn. There's a showing of being sharp worn. And when it's a showing of being sharp worn as a soccer player, all that's going to happen is you're not going to kick the balls good. And maybe you get embarrassed. Or a baseball player, you're not going to catch the ball or run it down as well. And maybe you get embarrassed. But you're not going to get punched in the head. When it happens in boxing, you're going to get punched in the freaking head. And again, I think the Nevada Commission's got to be looked at. I think the New York Commission has to be called to the mat. They still haven't, as far as I know, sent a team of medical people, proper medical people, to evaluate Ryan Garcia before this monumental, difficult fight. Dangerous fight that he's going to have with Devin Haney. What are these commissions doing? They're commissioners. If they're not looking out for the welfare of the fighters, why are they there? I'm going to say, he got knocked out. He got stopped in the seventh round. Lawson, I didn't like the way his legs looked from the beginning. The commission allowed him to fight after he got stopped in one round by Ortiz. You chronicled it. That was the fight where Tony Weeks stopped it fast and then afterwards said, well, I stopped it because, or basically intimated that he stopped it because he had failed a brain scan. Then he took it down. Then that disappeared. It all disappeared. And the commission had a choice to make. They decided to put him in as an opponent for Rocha. Again, don't anybody give it the eye test and do their due diligence and say, wait a minute, this guy's legs don't right. Let's do some more. I know they did testing on him, but when you see legs, old legs on a fighter, you got to have some concern. You have to. Even if his scans are okay, you got to go deeper then. Whatever. All I know is the commission's going to say, we medically cleared him and we put him in with Roker as an opponent because he was the big underdog. Okay, at the end of the day, are you going to feel, is the commission going to feel like that they were shown to be right? That it was rectified what they did? That it was shown to be the correct move when the guy gets knocked out in seven? I don't think so. Now, I know anyone could get knocked out, but they put a guy in. It's not anyone. This ain't anyone. This is a guy who got knocked out in one round by Virgil Ortiz, who there was controversy all over the place. If he had failed a CAT scan or a brain scan, they put him back in with a fighter who was a big favorite, and he gets stopped again. Yeah, it went seven rounds, but he got wobbled a couple times during the course of the fight. He didn't look sturdy from the outset. So I that's the only reason I'm bringing up. This is what I'm saying, my conclusion. I'm worried about Lawson. I'm not trying to stop him from making a living. God bless him. He's a fighter. He makes a living doing. I don't want to take that away. But I don't want to take your life away either. I don't want to take your health away either. That's more important to me, that you're there for your family. So at the end of the day, I'm just concerned about Lawson and the other Lawsons out there that a commission is supposed to have a responsibility to look at in a much, much deeper way before they just clear him to fight, especially after coming off a one-round knockout loss. Controversy and all, you have a responsibility to really say, where are we going with this guy? Where is his career at? He's older now. He's got a certain amount of tough fights in his career. Where are we going with him? He's, you know what I mean? Yeah, you take a freaking car that has a lot of miles on it and the wheels don't have a lot of tread. And what do? You make a decision not to get in that car with your family and drive a 1,000-mile drive. You make a decision. I'm not going on a long drive with this car. Well, you got to do the same thing with a human being. He's got wobbly-looking legs. He's been stopped. He's been he's at a certain point in his career. You got to look at it and say, do we want him going on any more long trips? Do we want him going in the ring anymore with this level of fighter? You have to think about it. You have to look at it. I'm worried about Lawson, but I'm worried about other fighters in that same way.
Yep. Nope. Good point. Last one here. Gilberto Ramirez steps up to cruiserweight, hands Arsene Goulamarian his first loss, drops him to 27-1, takes his WBA cruiserweight belt. I thought the fight was pretty even through about halfway. I thought it looked like Zerto might be gassing out after a few rounds, but he picked it up and outboxed him, I thought, in the second half of the fight. But dying to hear what you thought of this. What you thought of Zerto at Cruiser? Does he have a long career there? How'd you like the performance?
I love Ramirez. And at Cruiserweight, I thought he would become the champion. He beat Smith in his first fight. Tough fight, Joe Smith. He beat him. Both of them former light heavyweights. Matter of fact, Ramirez, former super middleweight champion. And then he moved up to light heavyweight. He got his only loss to the great Beevil.
Yep.
And nothing to be embarrassed about. He moves up to cruiserweight. He fights his first fight there with Joe Smith. Really good fight, competitive fight. Ramirez wins it. And I thought right there, I said, Ramirez is going to be the cruiserweight champ. I had no doubt in my mind. And Goulamarian was tough guy, strong, bigger, naturally the bigger guy, physically stronger guy, probably the better puncher, not the sharper puncher, but the better puncher, but just too slow and a little too crude. You know, Ramirez technically better, sharper, more versatile, more options. He could move. He could fight inside, outside, counterpunch. He could do more things. For Gulamirian, he's pretty much a one-trick pony. He's got to walk you down, put very tough, very strong, put pressure on you, wear you down with the pressure, catch you with body shots, hurt you with head shots. You know, that's what he likes to do. And that's what he needed to do, and he couldn't do it. Not against Ramirez. Again, he was too crude and slow walking in, while Ramirez was faster, more agile, as I said, more dimensional, technically better. The trainer's done a good job with him. I haven't seen a technical improvement with Gulamirian, to be honest with you. I see what I've always seen. A strong, determined, hard-punching guy that just walks straight in. And that's going to win you a certain amount of fights with certain fighters. But it's going to lose you with the fighters that are also a little smarter, a little technically more improved or developed. At the end of the day, Gulamirian did everything he could. He put pressure on. One thing he didn't do, I thought he could have, and his corner didn't implore him to do, to be honest. I thought he would have gave himself a better chance to win if he went to the body more, Ken. He's fighting a guy who's naturally smaller, naturally faster, naturally more agile, and Ramirez was boxing, using a ring early on. He changed a little bit towards the end, but the last half or last quarter of the fight. But before that, he was moving, picking spots, trying to keep Gulamirian off balance, keep him from getting set. I couldn't believe Gulamirian didn't go to the body. That should have been the whole fight plan. Jab, come in behind a jab, and go to the body. And try to take the legs away from Ramirez early on so you can start getting to him later on, where he'll be less agile. There'll be less movement. But he never went to the body in any kind of way or consistent way.
One other interesting thing to point out, he fought in December of 2019. Then his next fight was in November of 22. And then he was off for another year and a half before this fight. I mean, this guy is as inactive as you like. And in his 27, now 28 fights, this was the first fight ever in the U.S. He fought in Canada once and in Germany twice. Other than that, every single fight was in France. Just an interesting record. I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't recognize any of the names.
Well, that's how you build up a record of a fighter who's not as technically good, as I said, who relies mostly on power, mostly on aggression, mostly on toughness. You can get away with that if you pick your opponents right. But when you've got to fight guys like Ramirez, you get exposed.
He's Armenian, but a French national, but he lives in Glendale, California. For living in Glendale and being a cruiserweight champ, you think he'd be capitalizing on that big U.S. Armenian audience. I don't know, just an interesting stat line. I didn't know much about him and still don't.
Well, at the end of the day, you know this much about him. He's still slow. He's still not the hardest guy to hit. He's still tough. He's still strong. But he still comes up, you know, a day late and a dollar short with a guy who's technically better. Yeah. And that's what happened. But he got outworked. Ramirez, besides being a smart fighter, he's busy. He is. He's a busy guy. He was busy. He used his jab well. He moved early on really well, keeping Gulamirian off balance, picking spots, all of that. The thing that really, really grabbed me about Ramirez was the last part of the fight, where he didn't continue to just use his legs and jab, and which he was doing early, which got him, you know, obviously ahead in the fight and keeping the stronger Gulamirian off balance. But what I loved about Ramirez was in the last few rounds, I was falling asleep during the damn thing because it went on at freaking 1 in the morning. It was absurd. It was absurd.
I know.
But at the end, I thought I was watching a different fight. I woke up, and now instead of seeing him move around and jab and stay on the outside, all of a sudden I see another dimension to Ramirez. He's standing in front of the stronger Gulamarian, a la the late, great Pernell Whitaker, who was one of my favorite fighters and favorite people, Sweet Pea. I miss him. I think a lot of people miss him. He was what his nickname says, Sweet Pea. Yeah, he was sweet in the ring, but he was a sweet person. He really was. And he was sweet to watch.
Yeah.
And the way Whitaker did it, one of the great defensive fighters of our time, was he did it right in front of you. He stood right in front of you, like Customato would say. You couldn't hit him in the backside with a handful of buckshot, you know? And he stands right in front of you. And he moves his head, and he makes you miss, and he counters back. That's what Whitaker did. That's what, when I woke up, I said, what happened? Now Ramirez is fighting a different fight. He's right in front of the guy. You know, he got to that comfort level. He got to that that confidence place where he said, you know what? I could just stand in front of this guy. He's slow enough. He's easy enough to catch, right, and to find. I stand right in front of him for the most part. I'll make a miss. I'll counter back. I'll make a miss. Bang, bang, bang. Make a miss. Bang, bang, bang. And he was doing that, and I was like, wow, I'm glad I woke up. You bums, why'd you put on a fight so damn late? I could have sawed straight through. But that was impressive to see Ramirez doing a Pernell Whitaker in the ring at cruiserweight instead of what Pernell did it. He did it at like four different weights. He did it at junior lightweight. He did it at lightweight. He did it at welterweight. He did it at junior middleweight. I mean, he was special. But at the end of the day, dominant, smart, and dominant performance for Ramirez against, as I said, a bigger, slower, very game, but outworked and outsmarted and out-techniqued opponent. I would love to see Ramirez in there with Jai Apatea. He's 24-0 with 18 knockouts. He's one of the cruiserweight champs, I believe. I hope I'm saying his name right, Jai Apatea, and I would
yeah that's right.
I would love to see Ramirez with him because I like Jai Apatea. I like him a lot. I think he's very good. And right now, I think him and Ramirez are the two best cruiserweights in the world, and I would love to see them fight each other. I guess.
Yeah, that'd be a good one.
The only way we're ever going to get that, probably the way things are nowadays, is because these promoters, if they don't control both guys, you're not going to get it. The only way you're going to get it now is you got to go talk to His Excellency Turki Alashik over in Saudi Arabia and ask him to make it. Because otherwise you don't get, you know, you just don't get those fights. I'm looking forward to Munguia and Canelo, though. I am looking forward. Of course, I'm looking forward to Fury and Usyk. I'm looking forward to Bivol and Beterbiev. We'll talk about those fights when they get closer. We'll break them down. But I'm looking forward also to Canelo and Munguia. I won't get into it heavy, but, you know, experience-wise, you got to... Even technical-wise, you got to favor Canelo. You have to. Even though he's getting older, I think he might be slipping a little bit. McGee is younger. He's still improving. He's still getting better. But Canelo's a good counterpuncher. He's a good puncher. He's a straighter, shorter puncher than McGee. I think there's a chance he could catch McGee, who's got a great chin, but there's a chance he could hurt him coming in, catch him coming in with something. But I think it's a very interesting fight. Youth against experience. It's a very interesting fight.
Well, Teddy, that's a pretty pretty thorough breakdown of all those fights. Next week, pretty quiet on the boxing front. There's a Brendan Allen and Chris Curtis rematch on the UFC. And then we'll, but next week we'll break down that UFC card fight night. But more importantly, we'll do a preview of the upcoming UFC 300 from Vegas that I know you're going to be at with your bad wheel and all. The crutches didn't last very long. I don't imagine the brace is going to last very long. So it'll be, that'll be a fun event.
The only thing I feel bad about the crutches, Ken, to be honest, that they're made out of aluminum, not wood, because we could have made a nice fire.
Fair enough.
No, because they didn't last long. Because as soon as I could chuck them, I chucked them. And they could have been a beautiful fire. But I'm again, all joking aside, I'm very appreciative to all the people. My family, starting with my family, the people in Saudi Arabia, everybody, the Fury people, the Turkey Alice Sheikh's people, all his people, from Sultan to Ali to Usuf to just everybody that have been part of my healing. You know, you heal a lot better when you know you have a lot of love around you. You know, you do. You actually do. Because part of the healing is up here. It's mental. It's physical, but it's mental. That you have to be in a good frame of mind. And when you know you have people that care about you, you're in a better frame of mind. I said that before with my foundation. I'll finish with that. You know, yeah, we write checks. Yeah, we buy equipment for families that don't have the ability to get equipment for a paralyzed child or sick child or, you know, send them out of state to get a proper treatment program, whatever it is. But the most important thing we do is, in the little way we do it, no better than any other foundation, no better, no more, no less. But the little thing that we do, the most important part of it, is that we let people know that they're cared about. Because when people start thinking they're all alone and they're not cared about, they're not important, things go downhill fast, real fast. And that's the most important. More important than writing a check, buying a piece of equipment, whatever, paying for a hospital bill. The most important thing is just to let somebody know they're not alone, that they matter.
Yep.
And I'll leave with that. You know, after Easter, I hope everyone, like I said, had a great Easter. I know coming up in a few weeks, our great Jewish fans and brothers and sisters out there will be having Passover. I hope that all, as I've said before, all our Muslim brothers and sisters had a holy, healthy Ramadan. But I will just tell everybody that no matter where you're from in the world, no matter what race or creed or religion you are, I hope you have somebody to care about you. I hope you have somebody to and if you don't, I just want to tell you that you have people that don't even know you that are sending out thoughts to anyone out there that might be alone, to saying that you are cared about. I know it's spiritual. I know it's, you know, sometimes that's hard to grab your head around or wrap your head around because it's not physically tangible where you see somebody show up to bring you a cake or to tell you, give you a hug or something. But if it's possible, we are sending our hugs and cares out to all people. To all people out there, that you matter, that you matter, and the people out there that don't think they have the ability to do something that they wish in their heart they could do, like, oh, I can't really help someone, I don't have the ability to do that. Yes, you do. If you see somebody that looks like they're alone, you know, one of your neighbors or somebody you know is living alone, or you know, comes into your knowledge that they're alone, just take a walk over there. Get in your car right over there and just tell them, say, hey, just checking. You good? You all right? That's all. God bless. Yep.
And before we go, before we say goodbye, Teddy, I want to remind the listeners, if you're interested, Teddy's audiobook is available at audible.com. It's called Atlas: From the Streets to the Ring, A Son's Struggle to Become a Man. There it is. I've read it. I've listened to it. It's a great book. Give that a listen, and hopefully we'll see a bunch of you in November at the Dr. Atlas Foundation dinner. But and one more thing, you know that the one thing I carried through the desert last week.
Wait, let me guess. Was my... Hold on, let me guess. Hold on, wait a minute. Let me. I don't exactly have to, what was the name of that guy that was on the Johnny Carson show? Johnny Carson
used Kreskin.
The Amazing Kreskin. Let me see now. It's been hermetically sealed in a Warner mayonnaise jar underneath Warner Wagner's front porch for a year. But I will say, and Pedro, my friend Pedro, helped me with this, Athletic Greens were with you on your journey. And that's part of the reason why you had the journey, the successful journey that you had.
That's right. Athletic Greens, for those who don't know, is the all-in-one green drink made from 75 whole food sourced ingredients. You take one scoop in the morning every day. It's like an insurance policy for your body's health and immunity. And honestly, when you run down, especially when you're not sleeping good, you want to make sure you're getting all the vitamins, minerals, nutrients, and probiotics, prebiotics that Athletic Green provides. Go to athleticgreens.com/atlas to take advantage of a special offer for our listeners. 10 free travel packs with your first purchase. athleticgreens.com/atlas. Teddy, I'm glad the knee's healing up. It was great chatting with you. Thank you to all the fans for being with us. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. We would really appreciate it. And we'll be back next week with all the action. Have a great week, everyone.